My name is Harry, and I'm an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Atlantic Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA. And since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons, Kereth and Giroux, have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that you may learn here. What you may learn here may be helpful for your recovery and your understanding. Joni will read the preamble.
Thank you. And it's right here. Oh, thank you. Excuse me. It's what happens when you get older. Oh. Hi, my name is Joni. I'm an alcoholic. And hi. Okay. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not aligned with any sect, denomination, politics, or organization or institutions. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. Right? Thank you.
Please join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Lizzie will read the steps.
I'm Lizzie. I'm an alcoholic. The 12 steps. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. And 12, having had a spiritual awakening. As a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Mike will read the traditions.
Hi, I'm Mike. I'm an alcoholic. 12 traditions. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as He may express Himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible for those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers followed by our information break, and then our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Phil.
Okay. Hello, my name is Phil. I'm an alcoholic. Man, it's so funny. First, I want to give a shout out to all the people that hold this microphone thing down, like David O and Marty and stuff like that. They make it look good. And me, I'm like, but that's just self-centered fear. So, also, I want to give a shout out to Peggy and the people that made the Atlantic Group, because I tell you, this is the thing that saved my life. Let me get the stats out of the way. My sobriety date is November 1st, 2007. My sponsor's name is Jero. His sponsor's name is Mark P. And we have a family that keeps going on and on and on and on and on. I also have a sponsee. And it's I tell you, it's some interesting stuff. Seriously. Let me backtrack a little bit. I was a child that was very obsessive compulsive, I was looking for that drink. Even when I was a little kid, I was looking for something that was going to get me out of my head. Back in the days, it was comic books or music or things like that. I always had insecurities. I always felt like, you know, I had glasses. I was really chubby. Everybody was like, you know, I used to think like they were making fun of me. People are against me. Everybody hates me. I didn't know I had a disease of perception even back then. When I was a kid, I remember I was always foraging around the kitchen looking for food. Cupcakes, cookies, things like that. I know cupcakes are a part of my story too, but I'm just going to keep it singular purpose, right? Okay. So I found a thing of vanilla extract, and upon trying that, my sisters didn't want to try it. They thought it smelled funny, but for me, it tended to go down very smooth, and it was very warm, and I didn't understand why. I didn't know what was up with that. Now, my mom was just, she might have been an alcoholic too. Well, all right, this disease killed her at 50. And on her deathbed, she was telling me, you know, changed my life. And I wasn't understanding quite why. But let me back up to a bit. Let's not make it about her. Because it just, I used to think she was the reason that I became an alcoholic. I used to think it was that my dad left early. That was the reason I became an alcoholic. I used to think it was because I got molested as a kid. That was the reason I became an alcoholic. You know what? None of that was the reason I became an alcoholic. The main reason I became an alcoholic is because I liked what alcohol did for me. I liked the effect that it produced. Suddenly, when I drank it, I was, you know, I didn't have the glasses, or I was thinner, or I was all these different things. I was cooler, I was hipper, I was smarter, I was everything that I wanted to be in just a little tiny drink. You know, it was like this magic potion that I could get, and I said, now once I had that thing, you know, when I was a kid, they used to be like sort of, I'm Puerto Rican and Haitian, if you can tell from my accent, and what happens is We had a lot of parties at the house. I was the Puerto Rican side, so there was always a lot of Bacardi involved. And I remember at a New Year's party once, I drank some coquito, and it was kind of a coconut sort of thing. And I remember having that thing, and a girl gave me a kiss. I mean, like a real kiss. And I was a young tyke at the time. And I was just like, oh my God, if I could make that happen again, it was the drink. It was the drink that made that happen. So I was always chasing that sort of thing. Cause, you know, I was this kid that was always getting beat up and stuff like that. And I just wanted to be loved. Is that so wrong? So what I would do is in high school, the situation was, I was, there was always parties going on like that, and I was always going for the drinks, and the drinks would be the thing that, you know, there'd always been like some spin the bottle or something like that going on. I was like, yeah, that was what I was all about. And then eventually it stopped being about that, and it started being more about the drinking part. Hey, we're going to go do this over here. And I'm like, yeah, that's all good. You know, just leave me to this. And this is the way I didn't know that it was this progressive illness. I didn't know. Eventually, down the road, I started hanging out in the Eastville and going to Rocky Horror and chilling over there. And I tell you, those guys really knew how to party. They knew how to step that up a notch. So I started getting down with that. And there was always some wild partying going on there, lots of drinking and things like that. So what I started noticing is I found a whole community. I found a place where I could be free. I could be happy. And I could drink as much as I want. And nobody's going to tell me what to do. Eventually, I found a person that could party like me, a young lady that party like me, and she could drink like me, and that was all well and good. So, of course, I married her. So I married her, and as soon as I got married, it started turning into, you should slow down on that, or aren't you drinking too much, or things like, are you drunk? And I was always like, you know, what the? You know, this is why, you know, I married you because, you know, you roll like me. What's up like this? Now suddenly you want me to be like normal people? And I was just like, I couldn't get with that. So, of course, I had to get divorced. I had to, you know, and it was really bad stuff, too. It was really, she wanted to kill me. Mm. All right. Needless to say, after that, things got really bad for me, because once I got divorced, I pulled the ripcord, things got really, really, really bad, and it just led to me being in this horrible apartment, constantly, you know, looking out the window to see if the cops are going to arrest me, because I'm just so completely paranoid and obsessed with myself, things like that. I'm seeing bugs all the time, not just the bugs that were there, but other things. And I was also hearing things. I was hearing things all the time, also voices telling me how bad I am, how horrible I am, how... You know, and it was just me. It was this disease. Eventually, it was one of those days that I was going to die, and I was always 3 days, 3 days. I would want to get well, and then go, and then I'd forget why I was trying to get sober, and then do it again, and then do it again, and then do it again. And eventually, I couldn't keep living like this. I was going to die, and a voice came over the loudspeaker in my house. And I don't have a loudspeaker, but I was insane, and it told me, you are going to die. Now, I was like, what do I have to do, you know? You know, my mom warned me about this on her deathbed. In fact, I remember I was crying at her gravestone. It was so funny because I was thinking, it's like, this is such a moment. I'm like hugging the grave and I'm like crying. I'm like, Mom, what can I do? I don't know how to get sober. I don't know how. I don't know what. Now, eventually, I also do a public access show. And while I was working on the show, I ran into a friend of mine from the Rocky Horror days. This dude used to party like me, used to hang out like me, and he was all these things. And he was all smiling and happy and stuff like that. I was like, dude, what's up with that? And he goes, oh, I go to AA. I'm sober. I'm like, ugh, I was afraid of that. I did not want what he had. But you know what? After getting beat down a note, I'm a school teacher, and things were really, really, really bad for me. Getting into fights with my boss, getting into fights with everybody, it was bad. I wanted out of this world. I wanted to die every day. And I was so beat down that when I saw him again and he was going to get married and everything's good, I'm like, oh, I'm hating on him. I didn't know I had a resentment. I didn't know what resentments were. When I heard that voice over the loudspeaker and I was saying, I don't know how to get sober, I can't stop, I can't stop this thing. And he said, why don't you ask him? Why don't you call him the next day and ask him? So the next day, I was able to get sleep that night. And the next day, I called him and I said, you know that thing that you do, can you talk to me about that? And he's like, oh, that thing. So he met me and he gave me a big book. And gave me a big book and a meeting list and told me to go to a meeting. I ended up going to the Mustard Seed, and in there they had the steps, the traditions. Now, note, I have 2 college degrees. I couldn't read the things. I was like, those steps and traditions, this is like such a good idea. I should write these down. I couldn't write anything. It's crazy talk. But the main thing is, over at that meeting, they had that sign that says, we will love you until you could love yourself. And that's such an important thing, because I was weeping at that, because who would want to love me? I pushed away every single person. I pushed away my family. I pushed away my wife. I pushed away everything. I destroyed everything. And the people told me, keep coming back. You mean you want me to come back, this person that destroyed everything? Yeah, keep coming back. So I was cool. And then, I remember the second meeting I went to, I was able to meet my friend over there at this meeting. And it was an Atlantic Group meeting on Sunday. And it was bright. It was bright. Not like the other spot. It was all dark. This place was bright and everybody's smiling and trying to shake hands. I'm like, ah. So I was really afraid. So my friend was really smart. He put me in a chair and then ran away. And then people kept on coming up to me and shaking hands. And I was like, no. Stop that. Stop that being friendly thing. It's scary. I thought you guys were up to shenanigans. All right. So there's this one dude that he ended up becoming my sponsor. His name is Phil M., and he was just really so on point. He was all into the big book, and he started getting me into service and things like that. Eventually, he had to go to California, and I was brave enough and just lucky enough to get my grand sponsor as my sponsor now. And he took me through the steps all over again. We're going through the steps again. Now that luckily the steps, it helps me clear a path so that I can get a higher power, and that's going to help me with all my problems. I'm able to go through friends dying. I'm able to go through bad situations. I lost my apartment. I got my apartment back. A better apartment that I could, is beyond my thinking. With this, when I got my first year, I was able to go into another fellowship, and so far I've lost some weight on that 127 pounds, and it's like amazing. It's a miracle. And it's just from listening to suggestions. Like my grand sponsor, Mark P., always says, you take these suggestions as directions. So all those newcomers up in here, Sebastian Ola here, all the people up here that are new, take the suggestions as directions, listen to your sponsors, work those steps, because you're going to get a higher power that's going to help change your life, and it's beyond anything I've ever seen. Just look around you. This is a miracle. Enough said. Thanks.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Biet.
Hi, I'm Biet, and I'm an alcoholic. Let's take a sip of water. Okay, holy cow. Yeah, I'm really nervous. Just going to say that because, wow, the truth sets us free. Let's see. I'm definitely an alcoholic, and when I first came into this program, I was not able to say that. I'm an alcoholic, and I can say all the things that Phil just said in the beginning, like that I have a sponsor, and her name is Heather, and I have a home group, and that's the Atlantic group, and I have a family here, and it's all of you, and it's just so incredible to be here today, to be standing here. I take this so incredibly seriously, and I've never taken anything seriously in my life, even if I wanted to. I really wanted to take something seriously, even people I loved, and I didn't take them very seriously. I didn't know how, and it's not my fault, because I am an alcoholic, and I was an alcoholic from the moment I was born. And I feel really grateful for that today. The fact that I didn't know how to treat people my entire life, and the fact that I still make mistakes today, is the thing that allows me to stand here in front of you and connect to all of you. And that dark place, it's like where we find the light, and we do that together. So before I found light, I found a lot of darkness, and it all looked so good. It's really interesting the way the darkness is so secretive that way. I'm Russian, and I didn't drink, but my family drank really heavily. But casually heavily, like my father was a doctor, but also drank. So like, I never knew that it was a bad thing. I didn't have people falling over and puking or anything. I just saw like family and dinner, and I associated vodka with those things. I associated it with family and dinner. I didn't know that like, for me, drinking meant no family and throwing up my dinner. So I just didn't work. Even if I liked that, it doesn't matter. I was crazy. I was out of my mind back then. And I'm still crazy, but it's different now. It's really, really different now to the newcomer. Really, really different. So I drank. When I turned 20, I started drinking. It felt amazing. I was able to, you know, be uninhibited. I was able to, like, think I was living these hippie dreams that I had. You know, I'm a very open-minded person, or I thought I was, because I wasn't. I just, like, had an idea of what an open mind looked like. And I, you know, if I wanted something, I was going to get it. And alcohol helped me get it, because I was less afraid. And that's how it went. And so drinking, it was like 3 days a week. It was pretty normal. Even though I was depressed all the time, and I thought that was normal. I didn't believe, you know, that other people could really be happy. And the people that I heard talking about happiness were like yogis. And I was like, I don't think that's right for me. Like, I want to make music, and like, I want to like get it on with people, and I want to have fun. and so yogi, like, no, I wasn't into asceticism, and I really wanted to like find my own path. And so my path led me to more drinking, and anytime I had a goal, it all went to the wayside. I ended up dropping out of college because I got a record deal, and that didn't work out. And nothing, you know, it's not that like things didn't happen for me, because I've had luck and grace, as I'm sure everyone in this room has. It's what I did with those things. It's like, here you go, here's this wonderful record contract and $20,000 to record your album. We're going to drive you around in limos. And it was like drink, 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 drink. Like wore like, I'm a New Yorker, so like I wore like a turban and like a Selassie eye like pendant. Like I was so lost, you know, I just wanted to like... Not that that makes you lost. If that's where your spiritual journey takes you, that's awesome. Just for me, that's not my personal authentic, I don't even know what my personal authentic experience of God is. I discover it on a daily basis. Right now, it's this moment, and the next moment, it'll be the next moment. And that's all I can hope for. But, so it got darker, and... I discovered other substances, which I won't speak about, but they brought me to my knees, and they made my drinking way worse, because I needed to drink way more to sustain these other substances, and it was just chaos to the point where I never left my house only to get substances or to go to bars to drink and to hang out with people so that I could pretend that I was the woman that I'll never be, because I just was never going to be that woman. How would I become that woman? Thanks. How would I become that woman? How by reliving like the Groundhog Day of my life over and over again was I gonna become? I just kept starting over. Like every morning, it was like I have these huge dreams, and it hurts so much more when, you know, time passes and you get to look back and you're like, no, I don't think this is really gonna work out, you know. And I won't go into the details, but like everyone died around me, and I was not a good friend. I was not a good mother to my daughter. I was not a good anything. I wasn't good at anything because I was freaking out, you know, and the disease was taking a hold of me. And I came in here on my knees. I had nowhere else to go. I was really suicidal. I didn't think this would work for me. I thought people here just had lots of money, and that's why they were able to be happy, because that's what makes people happy, money. And I thought that since I don't have a trust fund, I'm obviously not going to make it in this program. I was wrong. Thank God I was wrong. I just recently, and I'm not going to talk about other problems, but just to say this, because I really feel like this will help the newcomer, my sponsor turned to me and she said, listen, you need to stop shoplifting. And I was like, why? That's an outside issue, and blah, 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 blah. And I'm mentioning this because today when I was coming, you know, when I was like getting ready to go speak at the Atlantic Group, which is a really big deal for me, I was like, wait, what am I going to wear? I don't know what I'm going to wear. I would steal something usually, but I can't steal anymore. So I'm trying to live this righteous life and like be a good person and take the next right action. And I'm wearing this thing, you know, this is mine. It's from the 60s. So someone else definitely wore it. And you know, I've worn it before. I really like wearing new things because I'm an alcoholic and I want to like have this fictitious thing that I more, give it to me, like make me look good. And it doesn't work. Like I feel more beautiful today in this thing than I would if I did something totally wrong to get this thing. You know, like you guys really love me for who I am, not despite who I am. And so I can just come in here and like some old thing. I can come in here and it's like I get to actually be seen here. I get to see all of you here. I get to hug you and wear a name tag. And it's some of it's really corny. And like I want to be like, no, you know, I'm not wearing a name tag. And when I'm feeling real rock and roll, I won't even wear the name tag. I'm like, nah, you know. And you know, and you know where that gets me? It gets me depressed. And it gets me alone. Because if I just surrender and take these little suggestions, these simple things that may seem corny, and I say, I'm an alcoholic, because I didn't think that sounded very cool, but it is. And I just come in here and I put on a name tag and I like reach out to a newcomer, oh, call like a bunch of newcomers, all these things that you told me to do. I get freedom, and I'm able to breathe. I'm able to just not worry all the time, and that's all I ever wanted. Just wanted to be with people and really love. And like I don't even know what that means. And again, that's like another thing that I get to discover what really loving someone means. I get to really figure that out here, and it's fun. And it's hard. It's really hard. Because sometimes I just get those old ideas. And I'm like, I'm going to love you this way. Because that's the way I'm used to. And then the God comes in. And I say, God, how am I really supposed to love? And God's like, it's kind of like this. It's like nothing like what you thought. Oh, wait, so you don't want me to be like really, really selfish? And just get what I want? And like be happy? It doesn't even work. It doesn't work, you know? That kind of happiness doesn't last. It goes away with whatever it is you got it with, whether it be a boyfriend or whether it be a car. As soon as you lose those things, you're in here crying. And it's like, I don't want to be crying in here. I want to be laughing with all of you. I want to come in here and surrender. And every time, even if I have to do it 100 times a day, I ask God to direct my thinking. Because that's what this program is about. And you don't have to never eat again and live in a mountain to be different and to change. You can come here and still be like totally cash and you can still change. You know, we get you. I get you. I love you. And like, I love every single person in here and goodbye.
Our main speaker tonight is Chris.
My name is Chris Dugan, and I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is July 21st of 1988. I have a home group and a sponsor, and I am honored to be with you. I had the privilege of speaking here once before, and it was, I think, Vince who had asked me to talk back then, and I about gave him a heart attack. I'll tell you what, you guys run like a Swiss watch. I was just grabbing a slice of pizza, and Vince calls me up. It's like 20 minutes till, and boy, there's a lot of stuff going on. And this time, and I've since been to this group several times, and I get to be privileged to sit amongst you most of the time. And what I'm really fascinated by is a lot of the enthusiasm you see. And the reason why that fascinates me is because it depends on how you're looking. If you come in and you drag your you-know-what in here, and you're just not feeling good, what you can see is really people that are all dressed up, and it's very tempting to kind of look at that and be almost put back by it. It can be very threatening. And then you see all the people that are busy doing the commitments, and you see the little sponsorship breakouts, and you've got 11-step workshops, and there's a lot of stuff that surrounds the transmission of one alcoholic working with another. But if you look at that from the wrong direction, what that can look like is pride and ego. But then after you're here a little bit, it it transforms. And really what you start to see is really the purpose of the customs. And that's what this is. That's everything that they're talking about. Not using profanity. That's a group custom. Having your speakers and having anybody that approaches this podium wear a coat and tie, that's a custom. But the customs always support the traditions. And what the traditions do is they really support the group's function, which is one thing, to make it, well, a place that a newcomer can come and find a solution to their problem with alcohol. And so really, this is for you. You'll see another place where you'll see alcoholics get all dressed up and kind of dressed to the nines, and usually it's when they're standing in line and they're on a list called a docket. and it's not for a dissimilar reason. Really, what they're hoping to achieve is a stay of execution of sorts, right? And that is really the definition of a reprieve, supported directly by our big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. What we have is a daily reprieve, contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. So really what this whole thing is about, and all this activity, and all the announcements you just heard, and all the stuff that goes on, and the list, I mean, you guys have it down to a science. There are commitments to support commitments which support commitments. And so if you're coming back off of a slip and you're waiting for like a red carpet welcome into that, I'm telling you right now, you're not going to get it. You're not going to get a hero's return welcome. You will be welcomed, and you will be reminded that this is for you. But very quickly, you're going to find yourself having to stand in line to get on a list. And I want to tell you why that's so important. And I really loved Phil's passion and Biet's sincerity, because both of those elements are really byproducts of what this thing produces. And it's true for me. I am certainly an alcoholic, and I'm going to get to my story very quickly. But the one thing I just want to say is, a lot of times when you do that stuff, you almost wear a target. And it becomes almost easy for people to kind of chop that down and pull you down. But I just want to say, I love you guys with all of my heart, and I support exactly what it is that you're after. And for those of you that do take pride in your home group, I want you to know that it definitely shows. From where I was before as an outsider and almost feel like an insider now. I love watching it. I love the strong sponsorship ethic and what that's born. Because it's for the people that really, really want to do this thing, that are going to show up time and again. And it's not for everybody. And this, I think the home group members of this group will be the first ones to tell you that. But then again, neither is this fellowship, which is why they are, and why we are so insistent on our primary purpose. And so my story begins a lot like Phil. I mean, Phil gave a great, probably 45-minute talk in 10 minutes, which was outstanding. I loved it. I loved it. And I followed it, too, which means, you know, you've been around a little while if you followed that whole thing. But and Biet, too, she gave a wonderful talk, too. And I don't mean to make fun, because I know what it's like to be passionate about Alcoholics Anonymous. And really, the one thing I want to make sure that I'm very clear about is that if you don't get anything out of the first two 10-minute speakers and myself, please don't leave here thinking you've been unwelcomed. If you're looking for a solution, I will tell you this. If this thing was not more powerful than booze, none of us would be here. None of us would be here. There'd be no point to staying. So the one thing I want to make very clear right off the bat is Alcoholics Anonymous in action is more powerful for the alcoholic than booze itself. And we get, individually, yes, I am absolutely powerless over booze. I absolutely have no power in the ability to control my drinking once I've started. That's called an allergy. And what happens is, after I haven't had it for a little while and I don't have a spiritual shift or a spiritual solution, I begin to get thirsty. The obsession of the mind. Couple those two things together without a solution and I'm a dead man. No question. But the reason why I love coming to places like this is because you get to hear the solution. So I just figured I'd throw that out right up front. And I'll kind of give you, and again, to kind of pull off of Phil's story a little bit, I felt exactly the same way. But I'll convince you in probably 30 seconds that I did not suffer from any delusions about being different. The fact is I was different. Absolutely. And I'll start with the year that I started drinking. And by the time I get about 2 minutes into this, you're going to say, dear God, just take a drink. You'll find a solution. So there I sat. There I sat in the sixth grade. Now, my sister has just been taken off to rehab because she had this thing about PCP and vodka. And she was crazy one day, and she was chill the next. And I'll let you figure out which was which. But so she had this thing going on with PCP and vodka. And then she gets out of rehab, and so she's decided to reform my father, who evidently has this thing for all kinds of sleeping pills and medication. I thought it was heart medication, but turns out no. So he has this pharmaceutical thing. But both of them were just it went from like, we literally... I went from having Charlotte's Web read to me to all of a sudden, like, there's pamphlets and leaflets from Alateen and Al-Anon to Under the Influence, and that became, like, the bedtime stories. Literally, we went from, like, now I lay me down to sleep, which the prayer always freaked me out, and I could never say it because that whole die before I wake thing just messed me up, to, like, we're reading, you know, Chris, you have an 80% chance it's a family disease, right? And so I'm getting these statistics read to me. Well, meanwhile, and that's going to stress you out, so that kind of gave me a little bit of an issue. But that same year in the sixth grade, I found out they started talking to me about that whole ability, you know, your ability versus your potential. And we just want to match that. And they call that a learning disability, right? And so they have all kinds of neat things, and they have you doing these blocks, and you're getting tested, again, which stresses me out. And I had this digestion thing going on. Oh, by the way, I was born without enamel on my teeth, so I have yellow teeth. So all my life up to this point, they're like, you know, Chris, just brush your teeth. What's up? They're yellow. Dear God. So I've got yellow teeth. I've got a learning disability. It's stressing me out. I'm getting ulcers, which in turn they put me on medication, which is giving me hemorrhoids. So I'm sitting on these little inflatable donuts, getting upper GIs and lower GIs, and I've got these shrinks talking to me, and now I'm reading Under the Influence, and I'm going to Alateen, and I can't even get my homework done because every Friday all the other kids, they get a sticker when they get their homework done, and I can't do homework. I mean, I'm not even paying attention to homework. I'm paying attention to hemorrhoids and yellow teeth and flopping around sisters and dad. My dad's having heart attacks, and he's getting colostomies and just all kinds of crazy stuff. And that was before I took a drink. Now, to discover, and I want to hold on to that whole ability potential thing, because I'll tell you what, they tried to fit all kinds of stuff in that whole ability potential deficit. And it was that year that I discovered the magic elixir, and I think you know where I'm going with this, to match that ability and potential. And it came in the form of a coffee can with all kinds of floating stuff in it. I love that your first, was it your first drink, vanilla extract? That is outstanding. That is outstanding. There's some in here whose first drink is like a martini or, you know, no, vanilla extract. I mean, that should be, that automatically. I mean, you shouldn't have to go through your whole bottom to, just right then, there should be something on the back of vanilla extract. If you consume this direct, you may consider calling this number. Put your number on there. No question. I had a very similar drink. In this case, it was cooking sherry and random. I loved wine in a box. Loved the wine in a box because nobody could ever monitor the level of it. So what you do is you go to a friend's house who has a wine in a box, and you fill it up, then you run off into the woods, and you got wine in the box and vanilla extract and maybe some peach schnapps and some tequila if you were lucky, and you got to grab that worm and then replace it with something else and run out into the woods and then just down that. And it was right then that I discovered, because none of it was supposed to taste good, and I don't think I ever, ever drank for flavor. I never asked, is this going to taste good, or what is this going to do to me? Two questions I never ask. It's, I looked at the look in your eye, and if it was similar to the way I wanted to feel, I was going to have it. Really. And so from the very first drink, what I noticed was a very dramatic effect where that ability and potential thing started getting matched. And that was my early relationship to booze. And I make it sound dramatic, but really for me what it was is it just honestly took me to a place where I could just go, whew. And our doctor's opinion in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous is the best definition of this illness that I've ever read. In fact, you'll notice in the first 164 pages, it doesn't mention the disease but one time. It talks about resentment, and from it form all forms of spiritual disease. And it's a matter of semantics, but for me, it's important for me to understand really what my problem is. And what my problem is and really, if you ever go to the doctor's office, and I've been on these sessions. I've gone a couple of times, once with my sponsor, once with my mom, a few times. And when a doctor asks you, when he's about to read you your diagnosis, do you pray? The information that he is about or she's about to share with you is not good news. And that's exactly what our doctor's opinion does. Is it takes you all the way through and it talks about, it basically says all the things that really happen to the alcoholic. But then it kind of leaves you to, do you pray? And there's no take two of these. As a matter of fact, it talks about synthetic knowledge, where before it was like, well, the doctor said, and now all of a sudden it's synthetic knowledge and the limitations of what the medical profession can do. And then it takes you to, do you pray? And thank God they have We Agnostics, because really, the whole solution is incorporated in that chapter. If you read it carefully, you can kind of see pretty much all the 12 steps in action. But really, it takes you through. Well, I was being asked those questions a lot. A lot. And every time I was asked those type of questions, it was usually because I was sober for an extended period without a solution. I'm one of those people where my sobriety, if you will, or the times that I try to stay sober on my own, is characterized by extreme mental illness. I am so grateful that I was pushed into Alcoholics Anonymous, because quite honestly, I was willing to do just about anything. I would have shaved my head. I would have done anything. If somebody told me, hey, listen, we got a solution for you, and it wasn't, hey, do you pray? Here's a book. Go off on your own. See you later. Bye. The way my drinking was characterized is I would start to drink. I would find that place where I could just, where all the, I would turn my head, and I still remember it. And by coming here, I get the privilege of being able to remember this. By being privileged to be able to work with new alcoholics, I'm privileged to be able to remember this. I remember exactly what it feels like after about the third drink, where I would turn my head and everything that formerly seemed very sharp and mean seemed calm and fuzzy. And I never had to ask what being buzzed meant. I just love that word. Oh, I'm getting buzzed. Just after about the third drink or the third shot of whatever, I would look for that place and it would deliver me to a place. But the problem is if I could stay in that place, then I would be permanently treated. But because of this allergy, I kind of go high speed right through that place to a place called blackout. Now, I want to talk just a quick second about a blackout. And for those of you that profess, if you don't remember your last drink, you're going to repeat it. I want to tell you how mean that is to people who black out. That's a cruel statement. I'm joking, but in truth, what would happen in I would go past that place of feeling that experience, and I would continue drinking and kind of go to a place that I wouldn't remember. Now, the interesting thing about a blackout is you have to ask other people if you've had a good time. And every time I would drink to the point, and it got to the point where I was drinking beyond my body's ability to metabolize. And one of two things is going to happen. You're going to pass out, or you're going to be a screamer. And I was a screamer. I would throw up, so I was not a quiet thrower-upper, apparently. I only remember a couple of times. But I would basically, if given the opportunity to drink uncontrolled, I did. And I would be screaming my head off in somebody's bathroom. You guys would have hated to party with me, because the parties always got busted. And at this time, I was working at the summer camp, and it was right next to a local chaplain who had one of those funny stickers on his car that I recognized. Back in the 80s, the bumper stickers were, like, totally in vogue. Like the whole, like, I'm an AA, but I'm anonymous, don't ask me. But here's a circle and triangle, and here's a little saying about AA, but I was anonymous. You know what I mean? And then you see that same, like, sticker, like, cut four people off of traffic and throw some trash out. That's why we stopped putting those stickers on, really. That's why I took mine off, at least. Somebody with another sticker, pull up. What's up, dude? Call your sponsor. So it's easier just to take the stickers off. One of the advantages of anonymity. But anyway, so he kind of grabbed me by the coattails, and he kind of ratted me out, and I found myself having to move back home at the end of that summer. And my mom did something that I wasn't to appreciate for a long time. She basically, when I got home, we went to the dentist, of course, which was a normal deal, and I don't know, they were putting a cap on or doing something, doing some kind of weird painting on my teeth or practicing something. And anyway, but I thought it strange that we were going to the dentist and my bags were packed in the back. I wasn't going to ask too many questions. And we were in that phase of our relationship where there was not a whole lot of dialogue going about that. Because if, you know, don't ask, don't tell kind of rule is in place. And she was working a good, you know, Al-Anon program, I guess. So the whole don't ask, don't tell thing worked both ways. But she heard. And she knew and she could see. And so we went to the dentist, and I got out of the dentist, and the dentist, you know, she pulled the dentist aside, said, you know, what it turns out she said is, hey, get this guy ready, he's going away for a while. And he came back with a tear in his eye, and he's like, a guy has to have some dignity, and did extra special good job on my teeth, and polished him up. And then, you know, what he knew and I didn't know is I was about to be sent off into a spin dry. They were going to take me to detox and straight into rehab. And it turned out to be a little six-week stint. Of kind of a spin dry, and it was fun. It was an education. I was there, played ping pong, got good at it. You know, they were sort of unsure whether or not to send me to the psych ward or to the rehab portion, and they decided, no, we better get the, because maybe I was a little bit honest in my intake. But the interesting thing about that is, I had a service commitment. I technically had an address in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll talk about that in a second, but you could kind of find me on the grid there. All the stuff. And submitting to this, meeting makers make it. And then I started watching some meeting makers not making it. And I started looking into what that means. Does going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and just checking the boxes and really having the address and really doing all this stuff on the outside with nothing on the inside give me any type of assurance that I'm not going to drink? Now, obviously, you could probably say, no, that's not necessarily the case. But what I was doing was speaking so much louder than anything I could possibly say. And so this is just my experience. What I found is, as I started looking into that meeting makers make it thing, and I found the origin of where it came from. The origin of that, actually, as far as I was told, came from an old Grapevine article where what they were talking about is the people that actually make the meeting happen. The people that you come and see that are wearing the ties, that are handing out the name tags, that are wearing the targets, that are passing out the literature, that are here making the meeting actually happen are the ones that make it. And that I could identify to be the truth. All the people that I have ever absolutely admired in Alcoholics Anonymous had nothing to do with what they said. There's a look that people in people's eye you can kind of tell. And it's that sincerity that Biet was able to convey. And it's really that sincerity that somebody with a handshake and a smile, you know they're not looking at your wallet. You know they're not trying to size up the type of car you're driving or anything like that. Really, they're just glad you're here. The people that are genuinely happy. And that's what I met in that guy, Kerry, the people that I followed. Men that have since died that I've absolutely grown to totally appreciate. If you've ever followed a man by the name of Chuck Chamberlain, he wrote a book. It's non-conference approved. I apologize, but it was a talk he gave called A New Pair of Glasses. What's more impressive than the book itself is if you can get a hold of the tapes and you listen to this old man's voice and the joy that's conveyed from that old man's voice. I hear that echoed throughout Alcoholics Anonymous all the time. And about 3 years ago, my home group, we lost our founders. They're dead, all of them. And I got scared, and I asked my grand sponsor, Clancy, I said, have you ever seen a group remain successful without a core matriarchal or patriarchal figure? And he had to think about it, and he said, no, not really. Not really. He says, it doesn't mean it's not possible. He says, it's just not, I haven't really seen it, where you see a core of enthusiasm and you can kind of trace a line of sponsorship back to sort of a central small group of people. And I travel for a living, and I really couldn't put that to the test. But when our founders died, it really kind of scared me, because I started looking around, and after a while, this becomes a program of attrition. It's really who's left is the people who you're closest to and who your friends are, really. And what you find out is, who's doing this thing for real? Who's doing this for the meeting makers? Who's going to make it? And sure enough, it wasn't the founders that kept the meeting going. It was the legacy that they conveyed. And what they did is the people that had founded my home group sponsored people who sponsored people who sponsored people. And that is now the core makeup of our steering committee. And we're back. I mean, we definitely take some steps back. You go back into business meetings and you start, you know, where you have years and years where you don't argue like the amount of coffee that you brew, and then all of a sudden there's like all the little internal stuff. But at the core of that, at the core of the legacy from the founders of the group is really one thing: making a hospitable place for new people to come and get a clear message. So I am truly honored. When Jeff asked me to do this, I am absolutely, truly honored. And the nervousness is the fear that I might not be able to convey accurately that which was conveyed to me, that this is more powerful than drinking, that this is more powerful than booze, because if it wasn't, we're done. That the higher power, or whatever you want to call it, whatever you come to find, if this didn't work better, there'd be no point to coming. And thank God it does. I am privileged to be able to be the coffee maker in my home group. I admire your guys' carafes every week. I priced them out. Our group's not quite able to afford the $500 carafes, but I love them. If you can get a good deal on them, please see me after the meeting. I'd love to score them. 800 cups of coffee we brew, and I get to maintain the West Bend coffee pots. And I'll tell you exactly how to tear one down and put it back together, because that's job security. And I've made sure that does not. And here's the thing. Also, if you're new and you're having a hard time finding your place on like the commitment list, and you can't get on the commitment list, make up your own. There's a way to do it. you can actually find a commitment to support somebody who has a commitment, even if it's just going to pick them up and bring them here. Find your own. Don't wait for the red carpet to get involved. And what you will find is, even though you don't feel like it, you will start to smile and be shiny and see that look in the people's eyes. So thank you very much to the coffee makers. Thank you to you guys making this happen.